not all feelings that are positive for us feel good. And one of the biggest myths is that optimism always feels good. It's something that we have to redefine and really allow it in its whole and entirety to meet us where we are actually at.
Hi, hello. Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea, the self-love podcast for women, though all self-lovers are welcome here. I'm Mary. I write and speak about self-love, and I'm best known for my book, The Gift of Self-Love, and I also host retreats for women. And this is the podcast that will inspire you to love yourself.
Our guest today is Dr. Deepika Chopra, widely known as the Optimism Doctor. And we're talking about exactly that. Optimism. What does it mean to stay optimistic when things are hard, not just for you maybe personally, but also uncertain for all of us collectively? And the power of real optimism, which is also the title of Dr. Deepika's book, it cannot be overstated. Optimism is different from positivity. You'll learn how and why in this conversation. But one of my biggest takeaways from this is how it's less about feeling good and more about building resilience, curiosity, and emotional flexibility. It cannot be overstated. You'll learn in this conversation what real optimism is and how it differs from positivity. We also explore themes of nostalgia, resilience, hope, curiosity, and at the bottom of it, emotional flexibility. And this conversation is rooted in reality. I promise there is no toxic positivity or empty platitudes. It's also oddly encouraging. You'll hear and feel more of Dr. Deepika's compassionate approach. And most importantly, you'll walk away with tactical, tangible tools that you can apply to your mental health today. Whether you're struggling with anxiety, we also touch on depression. We talk about creative artist people who are often susceptible to pessimistic thinking. We explore themes of nostalgia, grief, the reluctance to feel joy. Overall, though this interview is on the shorter side, it is packed with tools for your mental health and reframes for your mindset. So in case you're unfamiliar with Dr. Deepika, she's wonderful. She's a behavioral scientist, health psychologist, national best-selling author, podcast host, visual imagery expert, and sought-after speaker. She holds a doctorate in clinical health psychology and completed a double postdoctoral fellowship at UCLA and Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Her book, The Power of Real Optimism, published by Simon & Schuster in 2026, is a practical science-based guide to staying resilient, curious, and open even when life is hard. Dr. Chopra is a recurring guest on NBC's Today Show. Her innovative and science-based work on optimism, hope, and resiliency has been featured in outlets such as Forbes, NPR, Harper's Bazaar, Vogue, Goop, Variety, Fast Company, Newsweek, New York Times, Boston Globe, and more. Dr. Chopra is the founder of Things Are Looking Up, a consultancy devoted to the intersection of science and soul, and the creator of the hit optimism card deck of the same name. By the way, her email signature always signs off with Things Are Looking Up, and then followed by her name and everything. And I think that is just, it was really uplifting to be exchanging emails with her even because of that. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband and three children. Now, without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Deepika Chopra to Mary's Cup of Tea to talk about how to be a more optimistic person. Hello, Dr. Deepika. Thank you so much for being here on Mary's Cup of Tea. I like to start by asking guests, what's your proverbial cup of tea, like something small that's been bringing you joy lately?
My proverbial cup of tea, it's specifically this feeling I get when I'm listening to a CD on my Discman of probably something 90s and grunge while eating strawberry sour belt candy. There's something about that type of nostalgia for me that brings me comfort and a sense of familiarity, and also brings me back to a feeling of safety. And it's this simple sensory feeling that I think allows for just me to feel grounded and slow down my practices and optimism. But nostalgia, you could say, is almost like the opposite. It's about the past, but there's a lot of similar pathways. Being in nostalgia is my proverbial cup of tea.
Tell us more about its similar neural pathways to optimism. It sounds like it's the opposite, because when I feel nostalgic, it usually sends me into tears. But I do sense that those emotions aren't all like quote unquote negative. A lot of it, it's like grief for the past, but it's also gratitude for the happy moments we've been able to experience and then to relive them through nostalgia.
So, of course, it really depends on whatever memory is conjuring up. I totally feel the grief of like a lost time that you just would love to get back to, but it also is sort of reliving a sense of comfort and regulation. I talk about it a lot, but what the brain really prioritizes is not growth. It's actually safety. And so any sort of practices or tools that we can sort of do throughout our day that make us feel safe and regulated are very key in the idea of allowing our brain to grow and to look in the future and to look forward. For me, nostalgia and the way I study it is really more of a psychological resource. There's been studies that take a look at when you are feeling nostalgic and it is a safe or positive memory, even if it's something that you deeply miss and cause emotions of sort of grief or mourning for those times, there's this rush of dopamine that we get. It is really connected to that feeling of being able to use it as a psychological resource to find a sense of safety and regulation so that, again, your prefrontal cortex of your brain can kind of turn on and focus more on growth.
That just answers a lifelong question that I had, and I'll tell you why. So my family is Russian, and Slavic culture as a whole is notorious for, I would say, like being very blunt and with that leaning more like pessimistic. The idea that life is just suffering is in our DNA. But I also heavily feel that anytime I interact with a Slavic person, whether it's my mom, who I know on a deep level, my parents, myself, it's almost like confessing that life is suffering comes with this relief. And baked into that, my mom and every single Russian song I've ever heard always has themes of nostalgia. It's called Teska in Russian. And so I wonder if that has something to do with this interesting blend of how culturally we're not necessarily like happy, smiling, saying, hello, how are you? In fact, most Russian people make fun of Americans for doing that. There's this like chutzpah, I suppose, and like tenacity. I think a lot of like gatherings are formed around like nostalgia and remembering old times, not necessarily good times, because old times were also plagued by famine and Stalin and all kinds of fucked up shit and still continues to be till this day. But yet the old times and the remembrance of them, it gives something to us. And I couldn't quite pinpoint it until you said like it also releases dopamine.
Let me take that further. Being in nostalgia and using nostalgia as a psychological resource intentionally also reminds us of our own resilience. This idea that when you revisit past memories, whether they are really simple ones and they felt good or tough ones, or even ancestrally, you're also accessing the evidence that you have handled some real shit, or your family or your ancestors have. It's a reminder of persevering through your toughest days, and also a reminder of some of your beautiful days and that they don't last forever. And so the only way to kind of make them last and the learning from them last is revisiting them. There is this other piece of nostalgia that it may not be at the forefront of when we're sort of listening to a song and we have this overcome feeling of emotion. And for me, that's certainly music's a big part of that for me. And I can become very overwhelmed with emotion when I'm sort of revisiting the past in that way. And if I'm quite honest, I don't even know current music. I only actually listen to music from this one time period of my life. I listened to it in the moment then, like that's what was on the radio in like the mid to late 90s. And then I never stopped because it's so good. But right now, I think I've gone through so many identity shifts. I'm a mom. I have 3 kids. My life is wildly different than it was when I was 12. But there's something about that connection to who I was and reminding myself who I've become. And that is the same person. It's just evolved. Being in nostalgia helps me write. It helps me be creative. It connects me to more parts of me than what is just now. What are the labels I carry today? not all feelings that are positive for us feel good. It can give us that feeling of regulation, even if it looks like crying in the car, missing this very vivid memory of being someone young and free.
Okay, I need everybody to bust out a notebook and write down, not all positive feelings feel good.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And one of the biggest myths is that optimism always feels good. A lot surrounding the idea of optimism is something that has been misguided. And it's just, even myself, before I studied, really dove into studying the science behind optimism, I had notions about optimism that are not actually correct. And many of us think that optimism is about being positive. It's about feeling good. It's about always knowing that the bright side is there and that we wear rose-colored glasses and that things are always going to be great. And that is actually not the definition of a real optimist. An optimist, or someone that is in that direction of, and I say that because I don't believe there are optimists or pessimists, it's all on a continuum. Real optimism and someone towards that mindset and direction is actually someone who's very grounded in reality. And one of my favorite stereotypes about an optimist are people that say, and I still get them today, but I'm not an optimist, I'm a realist. I really understand that. I see that because that's what I used to think it was. A real optimist is actually someone who's very grounded in reality. They are keenly and mindfully aware of the roadblocks and the setbacks and the less than ideal situations that all of us face, because as humans, none of us are immune to struggle. But the caveat is they see those setbacks as something that is temporary and something that they have the ability to overcome, even if they don't know how or when or how exactly things will play out. But they have a belief that whatever it is, whatever comes their way, they will meet it and they will persevere through it because it is based on our personal historical resiliency. So all of our hardest days thus far, we have overcome them and we've built something from that. Optimism is much more closely related to resiliency and this idea of curiosity, which I love. I love the curiosity piece because I think we skip over emotions that are more neutral. We are very drawn to this either feels good, this is positive, or this is negative. And there is a lot of power and potency in neutral emotions. And curiosity can start when it's just a seed as something neutral. It can obviously increase into something that is positive. But even just the sheer question of, wow, I'm in a really shitty place right now, emotionally, mentally, circumstantially. I don't like this. This doesn't feel good. I can't see the like positive in it anytime soon. But I just wonder, how this will change. It's accepting and voicing, I know that this isn't going to last forever. That's number one. Mm-hmm. And not even committing to, and it's going to get better, but just saying, I wonder how it'll change. That small seed of curiosity is optimism. Like optimism lives there.
That's so beautifully said. And I see how that also intersects with confidence. Also, the through line being resiliency and that sense of very low key, as much as you can muster, type of curiosity where it's like, what would happen if? Or I wonder how it'll change. Kind of inherent in that is knowing that it will change and that it's not permanent. You don't have to like positive affirmation your way through that. You can just be real about it.
Exactly. And it's so interesting because.
Side note, a couple years ago when we were celebrating 200 episodes on this podcast, I made this little gift for you. It's called 200 Reasons to Choose Self-Love. And it just lists out 200 super niche reasons to choose self-love to help you realign on those days where it feels like too much of a struggle and you want to go back to your old ways, whether it's disordered eating, dieting, beating yourself up, being completely cruel with your self-talk in order to snap you out of that. I want you to reference these 200 reasons to choose self-love, and they're organized by category. So it's food, body, relationships, heart, and mind. This is totally free. I do need your email so I can send it to you. So you'll go to maryscupoftea.com/200 to get it.
And just some examples, like under the food category, it says putting full fat cream in your coffee and honey in your tea. Under the relationships category, a reason to choose self-love is feeling more connected to other humans because you're connected to yourself. Under heart, you get to embrace the full spectrum of human emotions, including letting yourself feel all of it. Under mind, a reason to choose self-love is to free up mental real estate for the things that are truly important to you. And it just goes on and on and on here. Let me try to show you. Look at how much there is. And it just literally lists out reasons to choose self-love. It's like a big giant pep talk on digital paper. So I hope you can get it by going to maryscupoftea.com/200. You'll put in your email and I'll send this to you. Read it, print it out, hang it on your fridge, keep it handy in your phone for those late night spiraling sessions when you're questioning if you're good enough. This will help. I wrote it from my heart and I hope it lands with yours. So that's maryscupoftea.com/200.
In my work, I study uncertainty a lot. Right now, in this very moment, globally, all humans are going through this collective state of uncertainty. Uncertainty is very interesting because the brain, when it cannot predict what comes next, and it is in a state of uncertainty, the amygdala, which is the part of our brain that is sort of there for threat response, is very active. And what it does out of protection is that it fills in those gaps with worst case scenario planning. It's not because you're negative. It's because your brain feels uncertain and it's doing what it's supposed to do to protect you, which is to fill in those gaps. The first part is if you're feeling like you're uncertain and all of a sudden, more so now than ever, you're like always imagining worst case scenarios. The first thing is kind of to be like, well, my brain's doing what it's supposed to do. So like, there's no shame in that. That's your brain in protection. A lot of what I talk about and what we're talking about here is this idea of how important cognitive flexibility is. And so that means it's okay to have worst case scenario. And in fact, it makes sense. And that is what your brain is driving towards out of protection, to accept that. But to challenge yourself, I don't like taking that away from people and saying, well, that's a worst case scenario and that's not great to think about. So you should just push it underneath the rug. I'm very much more like, wow, let's welcome that. That is a possibility. And I can understand why years of your life and years of evidence and maybe even familial, cultural, ancestral, so on, or your own experience in your own life has led you to believe that this worst case scenario is a possibility. So we leave that there and we take it, but we challenge ourselves. And what are some other scenarios that also could happen, even if you don't believe in them as much? If you're going to imagine a worst case scenario, then I would want you to imagine a best case scenario. And I'd also want you to imagine a middle ground case scenario and so on. Imagine 5 different scenarios to the same issue that comes up when your first thought is the worst case scenario. And even if you don't believe in those, it is a very important and strategic exercise to allow and make our brain search for, and this is not the whole story. What other directions can this circumstance go?
What makes me giggle about just that process is that I always think my anxiety is so smart and I've already figured out worst, best, in between every other scenario. But what ends up happening is something that I couldn't even have imagined.
I know.
Whether it's in a small way, because like somebody says something, you're like, I could have never even like fathomed those words coming out of you. Or in a big way where maybe it's like actually not dramatic at all. Or my favorite is when like nothing happens.
Yeah. Well, you know what's like, a great thing for you is when you are sort of in your anxiety loop and you're imagining the worst case scenario. And then if you are someone that's able to challenge that, it sounds like you are, and say, well, what could the best case scenario be? What could the middle? And then to be like, and I wonder what other scenarios that I can't even imagine would occur. And so allowing this like very small opening for, and by the way, something could occur that I haven't even thought of. I'm not saying it could be better and I'm not saying it'd be worse, but it's something I may not even know.
That's on the anxiety side. What about if we move toward the depression side of things? If somebody's life isn't objectively good right now, or perhaps their brain is just battling depression, what could optimism even look like for them?
It's obviously really important to caveat and say that if you are struggling with depression or a feeling of apathy or sadness for a long period of time, like over 2 weeks, and you can't perform everyday daily living tasks, you can't get out of bed, it is really pervasive and impacting your life in a real negative and, again, pervasive way, like it is important to get professional help. And I'm not saying that medication is the number one first draw, although it is very useful for many people, but even professional help in a therapeutic setting. And I am a big believer of cognitive behavioral therapy. So a lot of what we're talking about right now can be a great set of tools and help for people. But when it tips over to something that might be chemical or more pervasive and acute, getting professional help and tools, which this is not right now, and using these things and the tools like in the book as something adjunctive or with it additional is great. But we should not gloss over the importance of professional help, especially for things like depression. If someone's life is objectively not good right now and they're struggling, this again is where redefining what optimism is so important. If someone's struggling, whether it's with external circumstances or something like depression, which is internal many times, optimism, we're not talking about something that is things will get better or just stay positive. That's again, not what optimism is. Those thoughts and those notions can actually be very invalidating. In those moments of deep struggle, I think optimism looks smaller. It looks like getting through the day. It looks like waking up in the morning. It actually looks like asking for help. Just the mere sense of also accepting and realizing, like, I think I need help. I don't think I can do this alone. And then reaching out and asking for help is an act of optimism. It's because you believe that there is something that can be done, that you can do, that something can be changed, and there is a future for you that is better than what currently exists. And if you believe in that possibility, even if you don't know how you're going to get there, your brain will turn on the executive functioning to help you make better decisions and take action for that. So if you are able to ask for help, you are already in a state of optimism. And I think that's important to say. Even something small, like doing one thing that supports you. If you're able to be in that struggle and like take a bath or call a friend or something that regulates you, or listen to a piece of nostalgic music that feels regulating to you or mood boosting, whatever that is, doing one thing that supports you is also an act of optimism. Optimism is something that we have to redefine and really allow it in its whole and entirety to meet us where we are actually at. Optimism is not about glossing over the hard stuff. It's really meeting it head on.
I had a parental figure growing up who, looking back now, was clearly struggling with depression and covered it up by saying things like, happy people are stupid. And there's this kind of stereotype that cynicism is somehow a sign of intelligence.
Yes.
Like you see on the Reddit forums, right? That like you can't be happy if you actually know what's going on in the world. And similar with artists creating poetry and art and provocative things has to come from like a deep, dark place. What do you think of that?
I think it's so real. I see that all the time. I remember having a patient who was a musician. Honestly, there were so many moments and seasons of his treatment that there was so much progress, but there was this fear and sort of almost like kind of this idea of like, if he was happy and if he was experiencing joy, then he was selling out. And that he wouldn't have access to that creativity. I understand and I get, like I was telling you, when I'm in sort of my nostalgia loop and I'm listening to something that kind of is on the brink of, it's regulating me, but I would say if I had to label the emotion, it's definitely somewhere in like melancholy. I feel the most creative. I feel like I have access to just introspection. If unmanaged and uncontained and interpreted the wrong way, like this patient was doing, it can be really detrimental. It can keep you stuck at best, but it can keep you sick at worst. I've seen so many musicians that have found sobriety and that are happy and that are living great lives and are still putting out amazing music. As humans, we were built to experience the full range of human emotion. That includes elation, joy, curiosity, rage, grief, sadness, worry, stress, all of the emotions. We were made to experience them. And so sometimes just being more educated on it and redefining what that means to you and allowing yourself to be more flexible and more free in how you feel, you can have all of that.
May I also add hope? Because
yes,
I think art, even though it might be nurtured by some kind of struggle, it ultimately blooms from hope, because otherwise, why would you be even making something? Why would you even be sharing it with the world?
Exactly. A lot of people think that you have to be really angry about something and in disagreement with status quo in order to make a change. And that is true. That is one part. But the part that people don't understand, that most activists or artists that are making a difference in people's lives by sharing their true emotions and feelings and storytelling, is that they have to have hope in the possibility that something can change. That piece of being able to imagine something differently is the only way that our brains sort of open up to actually ideas and problem solving, and even are receptive and open to learning from. We really do form our optimism through resiliency. And so we need that struggle to cultivate that. It's more of this idea of and allowing ourselves to be and, to live in the gray, to have the in-betweens, and not just assume that we can only be creative or noteworthy or unique if we are just in our struggle.
Not all positive feelings feel good.
Feel good.
But we also have to expand the possibility of letting ourselves feel all of it.
And I think there's also this fear a lot of times that if I allow myself to feel joy and to be happy, that could go away. And losing it is going to be much worse than if I just allow myself to sit here and say, I already feel pretty shitty. And I know what it's like to feel shitty. And that's not really a drop. It's my status quo. I'll do that. It's safer. As humans, we were made to experience the full range of human emotion. And that goes for people that are stuck in the negative and that are scared to experience. And also goes for people that are stuck in toxic positivity, that don't even allow their mind or bodies to accept the fact when there is a negative emotion. Mm. And they try to sweep that underneath the rug and say it doesn't exist, when it surely exists and it will keep knocking at you if you don't allow it in.
Well, to close, I think this is a beautiful place to land, but I'd love to know on a personal level, just how we started. What do you love about yourself?
Honestly, and this has taken me some time to get to, it's interesting because it's kind of full circle, but I never thought that I would be doing what I do for a living right now, because I've always been a very deeply sensitive feeling human ever since I was a kid. When I first saw the Titanic in the theaters as a young person, I was wrecked and I did not go to school for 2 weeks. I was bound to my bedroom. I couldn't put myself back together because the pain was just too much. And my parents were like, wow, okay, we need to start shielding you from movies that have any unrequited love, any injustice. I literally could not handle anything like that. It is completely out of left field for me to think that I became a psychologist. And for many years of my training, I was a psycho-oncologist. So I worked with cancer patients and their families. And I always sort of thought it was a negative thing about myself, that I had so many feelings and that I had a lot of empathy. It sounds ridiculous, but when someone's in pain, there's a part of my body where I feel it. I've learned through my profession and also through, I think, just growing up and being a mom especially, and understanding what I have capacity for, to sort of contain and boundary that. But now it is my favorite, most favorite part of me. I love how deeply connected to my emotions and my senses that I am. Like, I love that I could look out the window, and if the trees are moving in a certain way with the wind, it'll make me cry out of beauty. I love that part of me that I honestly, like, really hated as a young person, but I love it now.
That's extraordinarily beautiful and I think relatable to all of us listening. Thank you so much, Dr. Deepika. I highly encourage everybody to check out your book, The Power of Real Optimism. I'm sure that there's so much depth and breadth about this practice, even more so than we were able to discuss here today. So congratulations, by the way, on launching that.
Thank you so much. This was such a beautiful conversation. Thank you for having me.